David Hawkins, always wonderful to have you, editor of Congressional Quarterly's Roll Call and author of the Hawkins Here blog and column. So anybody can just write Hawkins Here in the box and you'll get you, right?
I sure hope so.
Yeah, Hawkins Here. You are more knowledgeable about Congress than anybody I know, and I know you may just think I'm buttering you up to get you to come on the program more often, but
absolutely true.
That's not true. Tell us about how effective the Democrats' recent House sit-in for gun reform turns out to be.
Well, it was certainly effective at putting something on the national agenda that the Republicans didn't want to have on the national agenda, and at a very busy time in the news. I mean, this was right when the Brexit election was happening. It was right at yet another particularly heated moment in the Clinton campaign and the Trump campaign. It was actually the same day that Marco Rubio made some pretty big political news by deciding to reverse his retirement and try to stick around as a senator. So they got what they wanted, which was to make this a national issue again. I think it is probably their short-term goal. I don't think they're going to get their long-term goal, which is legislation to do the two things that they say they want, which is one, to restrict firearms purchases by people who are on one or maybe more than one of these terrorist watch lists that the FBI keeps. One is called the no-fly list. One is called the strict scrutiny list. That's one of the things that the Democrats want. And then the other thing that they want is a tightening of background checks to include such things as at private sales. So both are big long shots. No matter how much heckle they raise, how much publicity they get, because the NRA still, for all the unification on the Democratic side, which is to say that 176 of the 187 House Democrats, all but 11, participated in this sit-in. So that's pretty unified. That's about as unified as the Democrats ever get about anything. But the Republicans are almost as unified on the other side against more gun control, and they're the ones with the majority. And unless it's their constituents who change their mind and tell them to change their mind, nothing's going to happen.
I wanted to ask you about the recent report from the Benghazi committee. You know, $7 million later, it seems to me that they keep on repeating it and repeating it and repeating it. It's become a mantra, thinking it's going to be effective, but it really hasn't landed. Am I wrong?
Well, I think that, when this Benghazi committee was first formed almost 2 years ago now, and they put this guy Trey Gowdy from South Carolina, this Congressman Trey Gowdy from South Carolina, in charge. You know, the Republicans thought that they had picked the ideal guy. Before he was in Congress, he was known as a particularly zealous prosecutor, dogged prosecutor, but also kind of a straight shooter as a prosecutor. And I think 2 years later, you know, it is interesting to note that the Republicans, obviously, that it was. A thinly veiled, if at all veiled, secret that one of the reasons they did this was to go after Hillary Clinton. Congressman McCarthy, the House Majority Leader, said as much on national TV during his brief run for the speakership last fall. And in the end, they got nothing new on her, and they had to say as much. And so in a perverse way, I think this essentially helps Hillary Clinton, because this was the last best shot that the Republicans had to find some headline that they could say that she was culpable, and they found nothing new. Really, the only thing damning that they reiterated was that she used her personal email when she was Secretary of State.
And how has that stuck? It seems to me, to be fair, that email thing, that while it hasn't seemed to hurt her, seems to have more legs than Benghazi did.
Well, it does, because it reinforces several of the narratives that have been dogging Hillary Clinton for 20 years. And, you know, even her friends would say that these narratives have some truth to them.
Sure.
And that they have tried to get her to change her way of being. One narrative is that she, along with her husband, sort of believed that the normal rules of political engagement and propriety don't apply to them. And the other is...
That's what we call arrogance, isn't it? Isn't that what gets everybody in trouble?
Yeah. That's the one word for that is arrogance. And then the other one is that she has a pretty consistent habit of avoiding the tough questions to begin with, and then providing what would be kindly called evasive or dodgy answers when she finally answers these questions. And so the whole email thing kind of goes to as I say, underscores both of those narratives. Her trustworthiness is still the Achilles heel on her campaign. And the email thing is just something that, you know, Mr. and Mrs. America and me, to be honest, I mean, the Benghazi thing, I lost track of all the subtle things that were happening in Benghazi and what the aftermath. But I understand the email thing pretty well.
Sure.
And I think most Americans do, too.
Yeah, you got a rule, you should obey the rule.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, what kind of power will Bernie Sanders have when he gets back to the Senate? Will he be a different figure than when he was there before? Sort of marginal, sort of, you know, confrontational, but not that important. Does he become more important?
You know, I think that is, this is sort of a tautological answer, but that's mostly for him to decide. He gets to decide whether you cannot change fundamentally your personality late in your political life, but you can shape it. And he has a chance for a sort of something of a fresh start in the Senate. He also, if the election turns out the way he hopes and the way all the Democrats hopes, then he will have a big opportunity for a new role to play, which is to say that if the Democrats win control of the Senate, then Bernie Sanders gets to be the chairman, if he wants to be, which presumably he does, of the Senate Budget Committee. So in that, with that gavel, he would essentially need to be, he would have the opportunity to be either a President Clinton's gatekeeper, I guess, because I'm assuming here that if the Democrats win the Senate, that I think we would say that's likelier to happen if Hillary Clinton also wins the presidency. So if it's a President Hillary Clinton and a Chairman Bernie Sanders, then the chairman would be the gatekeeper of the president's economic policies and her budgetary priorities, and he would either be the sort of the gatekeeper who ushers them along or the gatekeeper who pushes them a little bit more to the left than she would like. So he's got an important, he would potentially have a very big role, prominent role to play next year.
Will the Democrats win the Senate?
Probably so. The Republicans are essentially down to one shot at picking up a Senate seat, which is the open Senate seat in Nevada, where Harry Reid is retiring. The Democrats, on the other hand, have, depending on how aggressively you want to count it, 10 seats where they're on offense, where they have a decent or better chance of taking a Senate seat away that is currently held by a Republican. 6 of those seats are actually in states that voted twice for Barack Obama, but that have Republican senators now. So those, just picking up those 6 seats would give them the 5 seats that they need to absolutely be sure of controlling the Senate next year.
Wow. David Hawkins, always wonderful to have you. When we come back, I got lots more questions.